Bitcoin has changed the time value of money, meaning that in the fiat world, usually things become more risky over time. If we talk about government bonds, for example, because the risk of default increases over time. But with Bitcoin, it works the other way around. If you hold Bitcoin as your treasury reserve asset, things become less risky over time.
This week, we are talking about one of my favorite Bitcoin adjacent topics, but also something that I think is just a critical part of the Bitcoin landscape for ordinary people trying to make sense of Bitcoin to understand. We're talking about Bitcoin in real estate and why Bitcoin emerging as a global monetary store of value network has sweeping ramifications for how investors will think about real estate as an asset class and how capital allocators will be forced to make significant decisions about where they put their money. And these forces are so big that they will absolutely change what real estate means for ordinary people. We have seen over the last 50 years, real estate become something viewed as an easy way to make money and increase wealth. And this has given a lot of people the impression that this is a permanent feature of real estate, and this is something that will continue on into the future. It's a really complicated idea to understand, but Bitcoin is going to change the way we think about real estate as an investment and as an asset class. And I really encourage you to tune into this week's episode to try to understand why. All right, welcome to another episode of the Block Reward Podcast. This week we are talking about one of my favorite Bitcoin adjacent topics, Bitcoin and the evolution of investing in real estate, with an expert in the space, all the way from Germany, Leon Bankum. Leon, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Actually, not technically all the way from Germany. We were just talking about offstage. You're in Orlando right now. I was just there as well for the Strategy Bitcoin for Corporations event, which was an incredible time. What were your thoughts from that conference?
Okay, cool. It was great. I mean, I'm pretty pumped right now. It was pretty exciting to see, or it's pretty interesting to see what type of heavy hitters from the financial industries were there. I actually underestimated the attendee list. So of course, we are all aware of the magnitude of what Strategy is doing, but actually being there in person, seeing how he embraces the retail investors, because I think that's, for me personally, something particularly interesting, how Strategy is embracing the retail crowd, MSTR True North in particular, and also the speed at which they accumulate capital to buy Bitcoin. And what I find particularly interesting in the way that they accumulate debt is that Strategy is becoming less risky the more debt they're taking on, because they're buying Bitcoin with that debt. And Bitcoin has changed the time value of money, meaning that in the fiat world, usually things become more risky over time. If we talk about government bonds, for example, because the risk of default increases over time. But with Bitcoin, it works the other way around. If you hold Bitcoin as your treasury reserve asset, things become less risky over time because Bitcoin grows in purchasing power and the risk decreases. And that's like a light bulb moment that went on for me also in relationship to real estate. That's something we can talk about in detail during this episode, is that the preferred stock offerings that Strategy is having, Strike and Strife in particular, they're tapping into the bond market with that. But thinking about it, they're also tapping into the real estate market, because the yield on those offerings is higher than the average yield on real estate, taken out the leverage component. But the leverage component in real estate, which increases the return actually, is difficult in a time of higher interest rates, because if interest rates are high, the cost of capital increases and becomes more difficult to take on leverage to buy real estate, for example, if you want to generate income. But with Strike, for example, or with Strife, you can just put in your dollar, receive income without leverage. And I think that also is a product that it will most likely attract a lot of the folks that invest into real estate because of the cash flow component of real estate.
Yeah, I thought we might get there later in the show, but it's a great place to start, because that was sort of my takeaway from the conference too. It was really incredible to see also how sophisticated they're starting to think about the different ways that you can use Bitcoin as a financial instrument to create different kinds of investment opportunities. And you just mentioned a few of those, and this notion that what they're offering is actually a less risky and higher return way to invest than in real estate and what that might mean. You have a lot of stats around this, and you know, I think that, so maybe we'll just pause there for a second and we could have sort of an overview of the topic. Real estate is a massive asset class globally. It has been traditionally sort of not just an income generating opportunity, but a store of value asset. It's collateral. This is something that has kind of become the bedrock of, you know, treasuries and real estate have become the bedrocks of the financial system over the last, I don't know, 50 or 100 years. If you were to sort of summarize how Bitcoin presents itself as a theoretical competitor for the money that is currently sitting in that asset class for a beginner, how would you break it down?
Yes, I'll try my best, but I don't think it's that easy. But I think what is important to understand is, why do people invest their money? People invest their money because fiat money is a bad store of value. And then what's the hurdle rate that they need to beat? So what is the benchmark that people want to outperform? And usually people want to outperform the rate of monetary inflation. It's set at 2 to 3% by the government, but it's much more. So depending on the year, it's around, on average, it has been around 7% in the US since 1971. But over the past 20 years, it was more around 10, 12, sometimes even 15%. So that's the hurdle rate. That's what people are trying to beat. And people invest their money into government bonds, which they perceive as a low-risk investment because of the low perceived risk of governments to default on their debt, which I think the risk is actually pretty high. But people think differently than we do. And then secondly, people like to invest into real estate. That is because of the scarcity that real estate has. So land in itself serves as a form of storing value because it's scarce. And people also get money from banks to invest into real estate, which means they can buy real estate on leverage, which increases the rate of return of real estate. So I'm talking about the US again here. The rate of growth of residential real estate very closely follows the increase of the monetary supply. So I just said that it's 7% for M2 monetary supply since 1971 in the US. And then residential real estate grew around 6% and commercial real estate around 4.5%. But then let's say you buy a property worth $1 million with borrowed money, meaning you put in 200,000 of your own equity, you get an 800,000 loan from the bank, you have a leverage of 5. So actually, what that means is the yield is not 6%, it's 6 times 5. So the leverage effect makes real estate a particularly interesting investment in the scope of the fiat world, because you can buy it with borrowed money, which increases your yield. Plus, there are some tax benefits in many jurisdictions. But now Bitcoin comes in. In Bitcoin, without leverage, increases in purchasing power by 50 to 70% year on year, depending on what time frame you choose. And it does so because it's absolutely scarce. There's only 21 million Bitcoin. And it functions at not just as a store of value, it also functions as collateral. And now putting it back to MicroStrategy, Saylor also understood that Bitcoin is this great form of collateral that you can use and leverage to buy more Bitcoin. And people like real estate, not only because it outperforms the rate of monetary inflation, but because they can use their real estate portfolio to incur debt, to make investments or to consume. And Bitcoin as collateral also works great, and it works much better than real estate. And think about everybody that owns real estate. After 5 years, usually as landlords, what do? We refinance our properties. We take out that money and we invest it into more properties, or we do whatever we please with it. And Micah Saylor, he's actually able to refinance his Bitcoin stack once a week. So he just speeds up the investment cycle like crazy. So as a digital store of value, digital capital, digital real estate, Bitcoin just functions as money much, much better than real estate, because real estate is actually not money. Real estate has a utility value, and it became money in the face of monetary inflation that we experienced since 1971. But it's actually, if you look into the human history, it's an abnormality.
Yeah. And it's the funny thing about 1971, it's like, it's just long enough that most people who were alive that happened before, you know, so we don't really understand how things were before this time happened. And And even, you know, in sort of the post-World War II era, yeah, homes were viewed very differently and price to earnings are very different. So all of these kind of the Frankenstein asset class that real estate has become, this is a very new phenomenon. And now all of a sudden we have this alternative with MicroStrategy. And so maybe MicroStrategy, as you mentioned, is offering bonds where they're paying out an incredibly high yield on an asset that doesn't actually generate any yield. And this has created some skepticism about the, you know, if it's kind of hocus pocus. Obviously it's not, but how are they doing that? And how, like, explain a little bit about the mechanics of how they put this together.
Sure. So MicroStrategy started issuing stock to raise capital to buy Bitcoin after they put their cash reserves in Bitcoin. Then as they continued, they started offering convertible notes, first with a coupon of around, I think, 6%. And today they are also offering zero coupon convertible notes, which allows the holder to convert at a premium to the purchasing price. So that's why people buy it. People buy the convertible note, even though if it doesn't pay any coupon, because they have the option of converting it into MicroStrategy stock at a 35 to 55% premium. So what they actually do, they are able to buy a Strategy stock at a discount. So, and the new offerings that they have are preferred stock offerings, most notably Strike and Strife. And I talk about Strike first. So Strike is a perpetual preferred stock offering with an option to convert into MicroStrategy stock if MicroStrategy hits $1,000. If that's not the case, you just keep the preferred stock. And you are being paid, it's, I think, 8% on the dollar interest rate, meaning so it's around 8% interest rate on this product, meaning if you hold that product, you have the option of converting into common share into the future. But if it doesn't, you know, if MicroStrategy doesn't hit $1,000 today in the near future, whatever, you are being perpetually paid out money or a dividend by MicroStrategy. And how do they do it? They can simply issue stock to pay the dividend. And the other instrument that they have is Strife. So Strife is also a preferred stock offering, a perpetual preferred stock offering with around a 10% coupon, where if you hold it in perpetuity, you're being paid out 10% on the dollar, which quite frankly is a better return than 3 to 6% in real estate. And also this is accretive to MicroStrategy. It doesn't dilute the stock. Think about it. Like, if you hold Strife, you're being paid money, but you don't receive Class A common stocks. So MicroStrategy can raise money to buy Bitcoin, which increases the BTC per share of the people that hold the common share, but it doesn't dilute the common share. So this instrument, I think it's really, really interesting, because Michael Saylor is able to raise money in perpetuity, buy more Bitcoin, increase the Bitcoin per share of the people that hold the common air stock without diluting the stock, because it's a preferred stock that does not convert. So these are two instruments that, from my perspective, as somebody that has worked in real estate for a long time, they're different individual preferences. Some people buy real estate for the tax advantages. Some people buy it because they know it's a great store of value in the scope of the fiat system. Some buy it because of the cash flow. And I would say 10 to 20% of the people that I dealt with, and I've been working in real estate for 15 years, I've constructed around 50,000 square meters of real estate, and I've sold around 20,000 square meters in deals. So I've been around and I've seen different deals. I've dealt with different people. 10 to 20% at least buy real estate because of the cash flow. They don't really care about the appreciation so much. They also like that, of course, but they're buying it so they have income once they stop working. But owning real estate also involves maintenance work, right? And owning Strife or owning Strike does not. So instead of investing capital into real estate to generate cash flow, people can now just buy Strike or Strife and receive cash flow. And I think that really plays into the analogy of Bitcoin being digital real estate. It's being this digital foundation for the way that we store value, but also how we see prosperity and how we build wealth. And of course, nothing beats owning Bitcoin. That's for sure. But the question is, can everybody buy Bitcoin and does everybody want to buy Bitcoin? And I think if I think about the institutional real estate crowd, and that is a big chunk of the real estate market. The real estate market is slightly larger than the bond market, but it's over 300 trillion. And think about just 1% of that is 3 trillion. And Mike Saylor mentioned they're targeting 1% of the bond market, which is 3 trillion. And now there's another demand group, which are the people that invest in real estate due to wanting cash flow. There's another 3 trillion of potential inflow into these products of MicroStrategy. And so far, I mean, they had their 21-21 plan, then it was 42-42, now it's 84-84. And I think it sounds crazy to people because it's very, I think, difficult to understand why it makes sense for MicroStrategy to take on fiat debt to buy Bitcoin, because Bitcoin grows in purchasing power so fast that it will outgrow the debt. And the dividends of the perpetual preferred stock offerings, they can be paid by offering stock. And by doing that, they're not diluting the shares as much as if they would buy Bitcoin only with issuing shares, because the preferred stocks, as I mentioned, Strife in particular, there's no convertible option in there. So MicroStrategy can raise large sums of money to buy Bitcoin, which is good for their shareholders. And I also have to mention, because I just mentioned the numbers, their plans, 21-21, raising 21 billion and 21 billion, they are just getting started. They will eventually raise hundreds and thousands of billions.
Yeah, this is something, and I think you did a great job there, sort of painting the picture of that there is no end to. So maybe it could be thought of differently as long as there continues to be an appetite for people to want to buy these products from them, they should be able to raise more money to buy more Bitcoin, which should create more appetite for people to buy these products. And there's also this interesting phenomenon that maybe we could talk a little bit about now, that is sort of the transformation of the utility value of a lot of the where the capital is being stored in commercial real estate. So shopping malls in North America are not what they once were. You know, AAA sort of office towers in smaller cities, like the evolution of AI and work from home, things have really changed how we think about the. And I remember seeing, I think it was in January or February, there was a pristine office tower in New York that was sold for, I think, $330 million in 2007 and sold for like $9 million this Q1. So there have been some early signs that the market valuation of some of these things is also really changing. You gave a presentation about this a few weeks back in Canada at a Rockstar Real Estate event with Tom Kradza, who was on the show ages back. And I'd love to just, you know, an overview of your thoughts on also how the changing real estate market is going to impact real estate investors and what people should be aware of, and your general sort of thesis around how Bitcoin fits into this, you know, putting MicroStrategy aside.
Yes. Great question. So I think it's important to understand that the demand for real estate, generally speaking, is tied to the rate of monetary inflation or the interest rate. So if interest rates are low, there's a lot of liquidity and that results in a lot of demand. And since 2008, interest rates were extremely low. So that created a lot of demand, and it created demand that was abnormal also in the historical perspective. So since 2008, the demand for real estate was something I haven't seen before. So I followed the real estate market consciously since around 2001. I started getting involved in real estate early, and I started working on building sites when I was like 12, 13, 14, cleaning out garages. And obviously back then I already looked at the rental price per square meter. I looked at the multiples, at the cap rate. So I was already kind of trying to raise my first money to buy my first property. And what I've seen since then is property prices were going crazy because interest rates were extremely low. And that changed in 2021. So after COVID, the Fed and central banks around the world, they had to put a stop on the money printer because inflation, price inflation was just out of control. In 2008, there was also a lot of liquidity funneled into the system, but because this money was mostly funneled into quantitative easing and asset buybacks, it didn't really result in crazy price inflation. And I think because of that, politicians and central bankers mistakenly thought that they could just flood the global economy with fresh liquidity without causing price inflation. But at the time, because the money was given directly to the consumer, also in the US in particular, it led to price inflation. And to counteract the price inflation, interest rates went up. And that was the moment when I realized that most people in real estate that I work with, they started to understand that the adoption cycle of real estate as a store of value most likely has come to an end and was rather tied to the low interest rates than to the ability of real estate to increase in purchasing power. In Bitcoin, as an absolutely scarce store of value, can do so even in the face of higher interest rates. So the rate of monetary inflation and the monetary expansion does have an effect on Bitcoin, like for sure. Also, if you think about it, pretty interesting. The halving is set 6 months before the US election. And I mean, Satoshi was pretty smart. So I think he also probably had a thought there, because usually if a new president comes in, they usually increase the monetary supply to cause an economic boom, which then they can claim to have caused. And so Bitcoin does benefit from an increase in the monetary supply. But I think what we've seen in the last 2 years, even though interest rates went up, Bitcoin still went up. So the bull market is maybe not as great as we expected, because we were expecting institutional capital to flow in. And I also personally expected a bit more retail demand, but Bitcoin still went from 15,000 to around 100,000 in, like, I think 18 months. So that's still good performance. And commercial real estate went the other way. So residential real estate also performed worse, but commercial real estate and shopping malls and retail in particular, they performed horribly. And I have friends who own shopping malls in the New York area, and they are struggling and they are trying to sell off the properties. I had a conversation actually with them like 3 or 4 years ago, and we sat down and I told them, I think you should sell your shopping centers and invest all your money into Bitcoin. And we had a few meetings on that. And they, at the end, they were just like, Leon, thank you. And what you say, there is some truth to it, but we just don't trust Bitcoin. And we don't want to invest, you know, the sum that we have in shopping centers into Bitcoin, because we don't trust the network yet. But the mistake that they made was that they misunderstood the paradigm shift that we are in. And this paradigm shift is happening very, very fast. And what I mean by paradigm shift is there's a fundamental change in the way we store value and the way we exchange value. And this paradigm shift affects real estate, which has been used to store value, right? And it's also interestingly being used to exchange value, because people lend against their real estate to get credit money to then consume. So real estate as money is right now being demonetized by Bitcoin. And it becomes very obvious if you look at the prices of the properties you own in real estate, you can see how quickly they're losing value.
Yeah, I think, you know, something you said there might be worth saying again, just because for listeners who didn't catch it or it wasn't quite clear, is this idea that this isn't a trend. And I think this is where Bitcoin skeptics can get sideways, thinking that Bitcoiners have an opinion and that there are multiple possible opinions, whereas people who really understand Bitcoin view this as sort of an evolution of how we think about money and storing value. And as a result of that, as a better store of value has emerged, one that exists purely online, that doesn't need physical maintenance, it's borderless, all Bitcoins are valued the same, they're totally fungible. So there isn't a question of, are you buying a shopping mall in Alaska or in Toronto? But maybe as bluntly as possible, to say it again, how should people who are really pro real estate and skeptical or anti Bitcoin, what do they need to understand about why the likelihood that real estate is going to continue to be the store of value that it has been is not going to continue into the future?
Yeah, I think that we have to check ourselves. And I still work in real estate development, so we still construct properties because that's our business. That's our expertise. But what we came to understand, and I have to say it the way it is, Bitcoin grows in purchasing power faster than any asset that exists in this world. That includes leverage, because let's say your house grows by 5% on average year by year, but you have a leverage of 5 because you took on money from a bank. Then, you know, what people would say to me, Leon, actually, it increases by 25% a year because I have the leverage. And I say, you know, that's fine, but Bitcoin increases between 50 to 70% per year. And if you take money and you put it into Bitcoin without leverage, $1, and you take 20 cents and you get another 80 cent loan, so you put in a dollar, of which 80% are a credit line into real estate, after 10 years, through any market scenario, Bitcoin will be worth more than the real estate bought on leverage. So let me give that example again, because the example should have been the following. You take a dollar, you put it into Bitcoin. Now you take a dollar and you take on, let's say, $4 more from the bank. Now you have the leverage effect of 5 that I just mentioned. And you take $5, you put it into real estate. You take $1, you put it into Bitcoin. After 10 years, no matter what time frame you choose, the dollar that you put into Bitcoin will be worth more than the $5 you put into real estate, because Bitcoin grows 50 to 70% every year. And that is just the case. There's nothing to do about it. It doesn't matter if we like it or not. That is simply math.
And so I think, you know, one thing I'd like to say about that, and thank you, that was very well explained. A common objection then is, well, past performance is an indicator of the future. And what if Bitcoin doesn't do this again? And this is where I think for listeners, it's really important and relevant to come back to where we were at the start of the conversation when we were explaining that MicroStrategy is now offering a financial product that is similar to real estate, only it has a better yield, 10%. And they can do this and woo away the people who would have otherwise put the money in real estate. And the amount of money that is currently in real estate is massive. So there is incentive already for people to do this now. And the more people that do it, the more money MicroStrategy will have to buy Bitcoin, which will push the price of Bitcoin higher and make it easier for Bitcoin to continue to hit that number. So if MicroStrategy has to pay out 10%, Bitcoin's performing at 50%, you know, the numbers absolutely do. It's obviously more complicated than that, but it does work. So there's going to force investors who even are the most Bitcoin skeptical to just consider the numbers. And like you mentioned earlier, a lot of real estate investors don't care about the real estate. They care about the cash flow. And so it's really a simpler decision for many people than most might think. And I think what one of the things that MicroStrategy is doing is creating products that will seem safe because of the rigid financial modeling and sort of corporate guidelines that go into them being able to offer this stuff at all. So there are a lot of complicated forces at play. I'm not sure if it's gone to the same extent in Germany, but the other thing I think people should be considering, sort of Bitcoin aside, are just the general likelihood of, you know, residential real estate appreciating over the next 30 years in the way it has over the previous 30. And maybe you could just talk a little bit about your thoughts on that. And, you know, I mean, like, what is the, even if that does happen, what does the world look like?
Yes. I think that it's really, really important. I have to mention it again, to measure prices in Bitcoin and not in dollars, because Bitcoin is the final line of gravity. It's the singularity. It's the new hurdle rate. And it changed the time value of money. In the past, and all of financial theory was based in built around an inflationary model, right? But Bitcoin is disinflationary, meaning there's less supply over time, and it completely changes the dynamic. And you have to account for your wealth in Bitcoin. And if you do that, if you start measuring your wealth in Bitcoin, real estate investing actually doesn't make sense anymore, because sometimes people say, I think that I should do both. And I say, you can do both. You can do both if there's significant tax advantages in real estate, if you can work with leverage, And if you can integrate Bitcoin, then real estate does make sense, because suddenly you're using the tax advantages, you're using the leverage around real estate, and you're also adding Bitcoin as a store of value into your project, which means that the resilience of your project and also the performance can keep track with Bitcoin. But other than that, once we dilute our focus away from Bitcoin, we must underperform Bitcoin, because Bitcoin is the new hurdle rate. It's what everything, any investment or any human action has to align with. So that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to align my focus and my actions with Bitcoin. And it does also allow me to still work in the construction business. But only because of Bitcoin, I think, am I able to outperform the competition and to thrive and prosper, even in a market environment that's actually hostile to real estate because of the higher interest rates.
Thank you. I think we've done a good job explaining the topic. I wanted to ask you a bonus question. One of the other concepts that came up in the MicroStrategy conference is the idea that over time, Bitcoin should experience less price volatility, meaning that we will, every time there's a Bitcoin cycle, and which over the life cycle of Bitcoin has been every 4 years, there have been sort of explosive upward price movements at some point. And the trend has been that those have become more and more muted every time. And so this is leading some, including some of the people at MicroStrategy, to think that this is a general trend, that, and so over time we're going to see a gradual smoothing out of the sort of increase value that Bitcoin is capturing. The alternative position would be that the more people who understand this, the more people are going to want to do it. And I think there's an equally case to be made that the opposite could turn out to be true, and that we arrive at a place where all of a sudden everyone is trying to get Bitcoin or these Bitcoin related products because they feel now that there's less risk, or the risk reward is more within their appetite. Where do you fall in that category, and your two cents on why?
I think I'm falling somewhere in the middle, because when I got involved with Bitcoin, I got involved from an academic perspective. So I wrote my master thesis about Bitcoin while studying financial economics around 10 years ago. And back then, I was looking at Bitcoin not really as a savings tool, but as a monetary network to transact. I even thought that maybe euros and dollars will be transacted via Bitcoin. There is something happening, of course, with Strike and the Lightning Network, but now we have Tether. So what I expected Bitcoin to be back then was based on my limited understanding of money coming from a Keynesian background. And now understanding what money really is, I understood that Bitcoin is this near perfect money acting as pristine collateral, as this type of capital. But when I came in back then, people were already discussing, is the volatility going to decrease? Funnily, most of the discussions around price action and volatility that exists today, they also existed back then. And my take back then was, and that is still my take today, volatility will slightly decrease with a larger market cap, because the price can't just move so aggressively and so volatile if the market cap is quite large. I remember in the early days, sometimes you had price movements of 70% within a week. And now we have price movements of like 20, 30% within a week. So the volatility has already dampened down a little bit. But I do think the volatility, generally speaking, will stay part of Bitcoin for a long time. That's for two reasons. Number one, overall, volatility is great because it washes out the leverage. And in the existing fiat system, leverage is never washed out. And that's why the system can't become resilient. And these boom and bust cycles that we are seeing are becoming more extreme. But with Bitcoin, volatility is crazy at the beginning of the monetary network. And then over time, it does dampen down, but it always exists to keep the system becoming more resilient. And I always take the example of an athlete, some of the best sprinters that we know and world-class athletes that we know, they rest before they fight, and they have injuries in between their training. So what I mean by that is, any type of organism that exists in this world needs time to rest and we sometimes get ill, we puke. And these are all mechanisms to clean out our systems. And it's the same with the monetary network. So the volatility in Bitcoin is important. And I expect a 70, 80% drawdown after this run-up to the bull cycle. So I'm of the firm belief that we are following a pattern that we can observe, right? But it's also difficult because if you think about it, like the future doesn't really exist. It's just a concept. And if we start to project whatever we experience onto the future consistently, sometimes we create a certain scenario where decision fatigue sets in. We make bad decisions. So I don't really try to time the market. If I use leverage, and I work a lot with leverage because I apply what I learned in real estate and also, of course, what I hear from Saylor onto my own portfolio, and I use leverage to buy Bitcoin, I use leverage to buy MicroStrategy, and I take out leverage. Like right now, I just took out some leverage. Just at the conference, I was sitting at the conference and I was thinking to myself, this is the moment where you need to take out some leverage because this just feels so great. And good things have to come to an end. And I do expect positive price movements now on. I'm pretty bullish on Bitcoin. I'm quite bullish on MicroStrategy and some of these treasury companies. And what I still believe, though, is that afterwards, we still have a volatile drawdown that will wash out volatility. And that is just something that will stay with Bitcoin.
Yeah, we'll just have to wait and see. I didn't realize this about you. And typically, we do earlier in the episodes, start out with an explanation of people's Bitcoin origin story. I'd just love to ask you one more question about that. And so at what point did you actually make this connection between Bitcoin and real estate? And you mentioned it's been years, but how did you make that connection?
Like 2019, 2020. So I worked in real estate for a few years actively after studying. So in my teens, I worked on building sites. I helped out on the weekends. Then I went to university. Then I started working actively in real estate development and also real estate financing. And around 2019, I started to read. Surfer Jim published an article calling Bitcoin Real Estate. He was talking about the UTXO sets as an analogy to land. So he was talking about the scarcity of land, the scarcity of UTXOs. And I started to think, well, Bitcoin is also this great form of collateral. It's kind of like real estate. And then Michael Saylor burst onto the scene. And he was just verbalizing like this so eloquently. He was talking about Bitcoin as digital property. He was talking about it as a treasury asset. And he kind of like spoke in a language that resonated with me because coming from real estate, I was always aware about how to use leverage and how to use leverage to outperform inflation and how to leverage a company's balance sheet. Because essentially thinking about it, as a company, you can increase your revenue or you can decrease cost or you leverage your balance sheet. And as a real estate developer, you're consistently balancing your balance sheet. You're leveraging your balance sheet. So it's always about taking leverage on the existing balance sheet to increase the asset side on the balance sheet and outperform the liability side. And that is essentially what Saylor is also doing with Bitcoin. In my perspective, and also how he explains it, he's using it as digital real estate, digital capital, digital collateral. So that was in 2020. And then I started to make the connection with Bitcoin and real estate. And then I started to develop these different strategies, some of which you heard of in me talking about in Toronto.
Leon, this has been so much fun. I so appreciate you coming on for what I think is one of the most important topics for investors to understand. I know you have a Substack, and maybe we just take a moment here to highlight for people who want to learn more about your work or find you online where they can go.
Yes, of course. So you can find me on Twitter and Noster at Leon Vancum and on Substack, leonvancum.substack.com. And in this episode, we talked about the threat that Bitcoin brings to the real estate world, but I provide solutions in my Substack. So as I'm still active in real estate development, as I'm still actively managing in the real estate portfolio, using Bitcoin as a practical tool to build maintenance reserves for financing and refinancing strategies. So if you guys work in real estate and you want to understand how you can maneuver this paradigm shift, feel free to check out my Substack.
Awesome. Thanks again, Leon. And if you're listening and you made it all the way to the end of the episode, I want to thank you as well for tuning in and hope to see you next week. Thanks for listening to this episode of The Block Reward. We're trying to do something different here, creating accessible conversations meant for people who aren't obsessed with Bitcoin. If you found this episode informative and engaging, hit that subscribe button to make sure you stay updated with future episodes. Your feedback matters. We'd greatly appreciate it if you could take a moment to share your reviews and help us with our goal of creating Bitcoin content that is simple and easy to understand. Bitcoin has an important role to play in the future of finance. It will change the way we save, spend, and invest. Discover why Bitcoin offers a game-changing opportunity for forward-thinking employers by visiting blockrewards.ca. Block Rewards' mission is helping Canadian employers implement strategies for integrating Bitcoin into compensation and benefits, supercharge your recruitment and retention strategies, and help your team members plan for the rising cost of living by rewarding their work with the hardest money ever invented. Special thanks to our top sponsor, Paramount Employee Benefits Consulting, Canada's only Bitcoin-forward benefits and pension advisory. For more information, find them at paramountbenefits.ca. Big shout out to Podigy, our production team that makes all this possible, and VMX Escape for producing our music. Bitcoin is an expansive and dense topic many people walk away from early. To Bitcoin enthusiasts looking for that podcast they can share with friends, family, and colleagues, one they'll actually listen to, we hope that is us. The content of these conversations is meant to be provided for information purposes only. Nothing here is investment advice. Bitcoin is a big topic. Be sure to do your own research before making any personal financial decisions. Thanks for listening.